David Bone Seminar Series 2, Saturday morning, December 2nd, 1989, 10 o'clock session, Oak Grove School, Ojai, California.
Yes, well, we began to discuss thought last night now, and the way it's been going, and perhaps we'll just ask to see if there are some questions this morning for a few minutes, and then go on from there. If anybody wants to raise some questions about what came out last night.
Well, we were saying that if there's any kind of resistance at all, it's a violence. It's a
well,
violence.
Well, resistance to thought, I say, is violence in the sense that thought calls for, seeing what it means and being sensitive to whether it is coherent or not, and simply to resist it as a form of as inappropriate use of force. You see, and the difficulty is that we often don't realize what the whole of thought, but it goes into feeling, or I call it felt, goes into the state of the body. It's projected into somebody else as an image or into the whole society. So most of our social problems are due to thought, and we try to use force to solve them, you see. And they never get solved, right? So that's the general idea.
Force, you mean the force of thought?
Well, we either use physical force in the case of many cases, or we use mental force, we use moral force, we use undue, we try to get across a strong feeling, a sense of overwhelmingness emotionally. Somebody may put on an emotional display force, or somebody else may use intellectual force to overwhelm somebody with arguments, or moral force. Various ways which don't meet the thought, but simply bring in some kind of force to push it aside or dismiss it. And that leaves the problem untouched. You see, that is, people then feel that you haven't listened, and that gives rise to their violence.
But it becomes a spiral cycle.
Yes, or else they accept it, but they still feel frustrated, and they take it out on somebody else, you see. Very often people feel very frustrated in society, but you won't make a violent reaction if you don't think you can use force, right? But it's still there, so you try to find somebody else on whom you can use force, right? Somebody weaker. I mean, that's a very common thing, right? Mm-hmm. And say people may take it out on children or on people who are not as strong as they are, and so on. You see, whenever you use force to meet a problem arising in thought, then you haven't really solved it. You've left more problems, though the force may seem to succeed. Right?
Is fear related to this force?
Well, there will be fear. If you don't have the power to exert force, then you will feel fear. Right? Now, if you feel frustrated and would like to use force, but you're afraid to use force, right? So you'll then feel fear. You may project into the other person your own violence and be afraid of it.
When you say your own violence, we were talking about the analogy of the TV screen and the flickering lights, and there's no violence in there. So that's clearly an example of where the violence in me is projected on.
That's right.
Can you say more about this violence?
Yes, well,
in me?
Whenever you think of somebody who has been frustrating you or doing you wrong, you may think of an image of him, and you project it, all the bad things into the image, and then you begin to think, I've got to use force against that, right? Is that clear? So, or else, if you can't do it, then you keep the image in yourself and you start attacking that image, right? Is that clear? But then you're attacking yourself, you see, and you get trouble with your organ, your heart or your stomach.
The way you described it, though, it sounded like we have, from ancient times, stored violence, like on the disk, these programs.
Yes, it's building up through the ancient times and perhaps from the beginning of civilization. You see, I think generally The evidence is there's always been some violence, but in the simple hunter-gatherer groups, there wasn't a lot because there were only about 20 to 40 people living together, and they all knew each other. They shared everything, and there wasn't much occasion for violence, but except by fear of other groups, right? But as we build big societies, people don't know each other, and you've got to establish authority and fear. See, the very existence of society is maintained by a kind of violence, right? People didn't find any other way to do it, right? They may say they all agreed to do it, but the very fact that you've got the police and jails and so on shows behind it is a kind of violence, right? There was no need for that in groups of 20 to 40. You have people, many more people breaking down mentally, you see, again, the greater stress. You have, then you built it up. As you built up wealth, somebody had to own it, somebody had to run it. You had to organize it, and you had to protect it with armies and so on. And you had to have rules which were very rigid, right? That implied a kind of violence, right? And no, then you had people discovered when they got metal weapons that they could conquer a lot of people. A few could conquer a lot. They could plunder them all, and they could make slaves, and they didn't have to work, you see, with all that. See, the technology brought in a lot of work, and then they didn't have to do it, right? And but then that was extreme violence, and also violence to the mind, because they had to say that it was right to make slavery. Those people, it was the right natural condition that there must be slaves, and so on. It was inevitable, morally right, and so on. And they made all sorts of arguments, saying those people deserve to be slaves. They're inferior. They lost the war, you see. And usually what happened was after a little while, new people came along with better weapons and horses and took over, and they became slaves, and it went on and on, you see. So this build up great violence, with that general pattern has not changed, you see. It has sometimes gotten better and sometimes worse, but basically the authority of society has been always had behind it violence, right? We've never managed to make a society since the primitive times which didn't have violence as the ultimate thing behind the order of society, right? And also the violence between social groups. Right? So we haven't solved the problem, you see. That the thought, that violence arises primarily in thought, but people then think that it arises because of instincts of aggression and so on, which complicates things again, you see. There's no evidence that the instincts for aggression were that powerful in very early primitive times, as they are now, right? There's this constant frustration and constant fear and, you know, using violence to get ahead, you know, that the basic relationships were involved violence, right, of one kind or another. In other words, people competing with each other and so on. See, the human nervous system was not really built for that. I mean, we had a million years without that, and then 5,000 years with that. So I think it's worth considering violence as one of the basic things that has gone wrong with thought, right? Or thought itself has introduced it because it hasn't solved the problem of how to bring about human relationships in a large society. Orderly human relationships. Purely on the basis of mutual understanding and friendship and so on, right? Where in these small groups, that was more or less, they could have quarrels and so on, and they might separate, but that was the basic way it held together.
Rules and laws are an expression of violence?
Yes, it's an expression. Some rules are necessary, but the kind of rules that were developed, which had to induce, they were very rigid rules, inhuman, they brought in fear, and so on. They couldn't get people to follow these rules without fear, right? They had to bring in fear, and that would bring in violence, right? In fact, it was only the threat of violence that ultimately sustained the fear. See, that society has not managed to function without that, right? And then if not fear of the police, there would, or the king, there would be fear of God, right?
Can we have structure without violence?
Well, that's what we're exploring. I'm saying we have to have it if we're going to survive. I think it's possible myself, but we must explore it, right?
It's seems like once there is any kind of set structure, that will violate something.
Well, not if we see the necessity of it. You see, people can agree that we're going to meet at a certain time, you see. We agreed this morning, right? It does not necessarily a form of violence. We all saw the necessity of doing that. If we don't meet together, then it won't work, right? Now, people then have to be sensitive and ready to do it, you see. But to put that first, right? Now, they may instead put some other interest first. You see, we don't get it straight, you see. Now, in this general atmosphere in which everything is organized by violence, it's hard to imagine how things could go otherwise, but I think they could, you see. We want to explore that, though.
There's tremendous structure in nature and the human
body,
and that's not violent.
The human body, though, is a very violent affair. It's constantly warfare, and in order to consume anything, it has to be completely destroyed first by the digestive system, so it's all violent.
Well, not clear whether that's violence. You see, I think it would not. There is such a thing as the undue use of force. You see, saying that kind of thing at least is conducive to survival. But the kind of force we're talking about is going to end up in a great deal of unhappiness and destruction. You know, this force by which society maintains itself. You see, I think that it would be if we had small groups of people, we could live fairly peaceably. Groups of 20 to 40.
But could we anymore? I mean, I'm just...
No, not now, not now.
Oh,
well, yeah, but not now. I'm saying that if you went back to those early conditions where you didn't have complicated ways of getting food, you went out, people spent 15, 20 hours a week gathering food or hunting, and they would prepare food in common and so on. You see, it was a comparatively... If there was plenty of food around, then it was fairly easy. I mean, and sometimes, of course, there was starvation and they had trouble, but it wasn't always perfect, you see. But there's a book, I can't remember, that has just come out showing that there's no sign that the health of human beings got better when civilization began. On the whole, it got worse. It's only recently that it's gotten better with, you know, more sanitation and medical science and so on. But I think we should now focus, though, on the violence as originating in thought. You see, part of the reason we haven't been dealing with violence properly is that people have said either that it's due to natural instincts like aggression or that it's somehow built into people. That, they're given, I think, what are wrong explanations of the origin of violence, and therefore we will not be dealing with it, right? Properly.
Could we say that there is no violence outside of thought, that action which takes place outside of thought, use another term, destroy, that it's not violent?
Yeah, well, in natural destruction, I wouldn't call it violence. You see, if there's an earthquake, it's not violence. It's, whatever, floods, windstorms and all that. But they may look like violence, and poetically we could call it violence, but it's not the same thing. that there's an inherent incoherence in this, in this violence which arises in thought, and which doesn't really attain its objective, and eventually it creates tremendous disorder and unhappiness and so on, and destruction. Now, I think therefore the thing we want to focus on is that thought. The kind of violence we're talking about, anyway, originates in thought, and people have not paid much attention to that. They have not really thought about it that way, right? Therefore, you see, dealing with violence, they might try to punish it or try to entice people into not being violent or saying you shouldn't be violent to oppose it. None of that will work because it's the wrong notion of what's the cause of it, right? Now, therefore, we really have to get into thought, and the violence of thought is very subtle. It's not just physical violence or emotional violence. It's very subtle violence in the way people think and exclude, the way they reject each other in certain ways by just thinking, and so on. Now, yeah?
Isn't that the violence that arises in our thoughts is a response to the kinds of conflicts that we feel within ourselves because of conditioning? A conflict between, I was thinking of the girl you talked about last night who thought her teacher's behavior was bizarre, but her parents gave her a response that wanted her to discount the her own senses and to deny that she was experiencing weirdness from her teacher, and that would give her a conflict between should she believe her own observations or should she just follow along with the dictates of the authorities to just ignore that and go on anyway. And when you have so much of that when you're growing up, you're in constant conflict with yourself and respond by being violent to yourself many times.
That's true, yes.
Self-destructive behavior, and then projecting that in your outside relationships.
Well, that's the further unfolding of violence. You see, it all originates in thought. You see, the teacher was doing what she was doing because she had been conditioned to think in a certain way, that this was right, or that it was the right way. And then you begin to think, well, this doesn't make sense, and somebody else says, ignore the fact that it doesn't make sense.
Does it begin with understanding that the conflict is there? I mean, sometimes we think that's a normal state to feel pulled this way and feel pulled that way, and then to respond with craziness because of it. If you could understand the conflict and resolve it peacefully within yourself, you wouldn't need to be violent toward yourself, and you would begin to unlearn the violent responses.
But the conflict is due to your way of thinking. You have two thoughts, one of them being, what the teacher is doing doesn't make sense, and the other, that I must keep quiet. Now, this produces two different impulses, which are fighting each other. Now, if you clear it up and say, okay, I know I can't change the teacher, but I'm not going to get into a fight in myself. If you can carry it that far, okay. But I think I'm trying to say is I'm interested in something deeper, which is the whole process of thought as it produces violence and conflict, right? All through society and over the ages, you see. That's only an example, right? Right. Now, so I think that we won't solve this thing by looking at particular examples. You see, maybe that person would feel a little better, but it still will be going on all over, and the whole process in general, this vast thing will be flowing, right? So we have to look at the thing more deeply and more generally. And in order to do that, I think we have to understand something of the nature of thought, you see. We pay very little attention to that, generally, in our culture over the past few thousand years. Now, I think we have to ask the question, what do we mean by thought, right? What is it? I've already said it's the response of memory as there's thinking and there's thought. Memory, having put down a program, memory responds either with feelings or with actions or with words, right? Say if somebody asks you your name, you respond right away. It's on your memory. If you have a more difficult question, you have to search the memory, or you ask somebody else, or you look it up in a book. And if it's still more difficult, you can't solve it, you begin to say it's a problem, I must think about it. And in a problem, you set a goal. You say, I want to do something, and I don't know how to do it. Like, I may have to get home, and I haven't got the means, and I try to discover the means, right? So in a problem, your thinking is generally directed toward a goal which is already pre-selected, you see. That is, your thought has told you that your difficulty could be solved if you could get X, and you only have to find X, right? But then that's still caught in thought. It's somewhat more active than just automatic thinking, but it may be that the goal you're set to solve the problem is irrelevant or even part of the difficulty, right? You see, in other words, the automatic acceptance of the problem is part of the maybe the main problem. That we have to say we can't accept the goals which are in our problems. You see what I mean? Because they presuppose the things that are wrong. Is that clear what I mean? So it's a deeper kind of question is involved. You have to question the whole kind of thought, which means slowing it down, right? If you question things, your thought starts to slow down. You make the analogy of a wheel going very fast, you can't see the spokes. As it slows down, you see how it works, right? The gears work. So you could say the wheels of the mind are working, slowed down so that you can see how they're going, right? You see how they're generating these difficulties, right? That would be one view. Ordinarily, our mind goes very fast. The memory responds very, very fast, and sometimes with emotions even faster. you can't really see what it is, and it goes so fast that you take it for independent reality. You see, this is one of the difficulties. The thought does something and then says, this result was not produced by thought. We went into that. It was just independent reality, and we've got to think about it. But as we think about it, we keep it going, right? So, and therefore, we now... while we keep it going, we're trying to solve it. Whereas if...
When you say slow it down, do you mean slow it down? And if so, what's doing the slowing down? I mean,
well, just raising the question will slow it down. You see, if you're very sure of yourself, your mind goes very fast. If you begin to feel, I'm not so sure, you know, it's not clear, then it begins to slow down. The thoughts begin to slow down, right? Now, in some sense, the mind may be speeding up, right? Your attention may be speeding up while your thoughts slow down. You're more attentive, more aware. When you're going very fast, you're not very aware, right?
So are you saying that's a relative thing then? To you, they're slowing down. I mean, are we talking about time right now?
Well, yes, you're not getting so many thoughts so fast, right? Suppose, for example, you're in a panic, your thoughts come in one after another. They're too fast, right? If you could slow them down, you might get out of it. You know, now, because you could see what's going on. No matter what it is, you see, the program is working very fast and you can't see that it's a program, but you see it as reality itself, right? And therefore you're trying to solve this apparent reality, which is really a program. You should be removing that program, but instead you keep it going and try to deal with its results. You see, that's been the whole history of humanity, right?
And what is it that's looking at the program?
Well, we'll raise that, if we could raise that question later. You see, that's a very subtle question. And I think that if we get into it too fast, it won't be clear, right? You know, we have to get some idea of the nature of thought before we could properly raise the question. Because we have to ask, what does it mean to perceive, and so on. Now, you see, there's a difference between thought and perception. For example, if we see sense with the senses what is in the room, that gives information that doesn't come only from the memory, right? Generally, our consciousness is the fusion of both kinds of information from the senses and information from the memory, from the past, right? So I recognize this as a table. It's the two together, right? It could be recognized as a flat bit of wood with, you know, with sticks, perpendicular sticks. You know, there are various ways, right? This could be potentially a piece of firewood, or there are all sorts of ways of seeing it, right? But the memory, it tells you this is a table, and you know immediately you can put something on it, right? And so on. Now, therefore, that's the fusion of the senses and the past, right? Now then, okay, so now, but also we have perception through the mind. We can sense when thought is not working right. We discussed that yesterday, when it's incoherent, right? And we can sense that things are related or unrelated and so on. There are various ways, things we can sense which are not sensed directly through the eyes and ears and nose and touch and so on. We sense relationship, right? Or non-relationship, separation, union, and so on. So that also enters into everything you perceive, right? See, what you perceive is the fusion of all that, right? Now, that raises the question, you see, we could call this what is present, you see, in consciousness or awareness. Now, present has a root pre-essent, meaning in front of, you see. It's sort of in front of you. That's a sort of a metaphor. It's presented. See, this whole net result of thought, sense perception, and perception through the mind is presented to consciousness, fused into one picture, right? Or one experience. That experience may contain a lot of false features, because the past, you could make a mistake in perception, and also the past comes in with wrong, with some wrong inferences. You know? You know, it might tell you this is tables of this kind, you know, are always can be trusted, but they might not be, and so on. You know, you could, you see, you walk on the floor and you are confident it will support you. That's the past tells you that. But if there were an earthquake, it wouldn't work, you see. So it's not always, you see. So but still, you need that confidence to be able to depend on things you know, to be able to live, right? So it should be presented to you as being really there, though it may not be there, right? But if it's not there, you should be able to discover it with your senses and with the sensitivity of the mind, huh? And then change your thoughts. Huh? That would be the normal right way to do it. But then if your thoughts get stuck, you can't change it, right? Now, if you're identified with them, say, I can't change them, then you get into incoherence. All right, so that's part of the general picture. You see, now, I think that it's useful now to think not only of what is presented, but of the word immediate. You see, there is that which is immediate. We can't really describe it. And then thought mediates. It comes in between, right? It takes time for thought to work, thinking to work. It mediates, right? And then that thought comes out in the immediate again, right? Because you immediately sense this is a table without having to think, right? All the thinking you did before does that. So do you see that thinking mediates perception and then re-enters the immediate, right? Or at least call it relatively immediate. Is that...
Can you do that again, please? What? Just go over that again.
Yeah, you see... yes, thinking. See, there was once a case somebody told me about. If you think of a person who has been born blind, for example, and he has an operation to see, then he doesn't actually see a great deal. He has to get a lot of experience and memories and skills in order to see. Right? For example, he doesn't understand depth. If he sees a set of stairs, he doesn't see them going up, right? It may take him years to see that. So it may be easier for him to close his eyes in the beginning and go by touch, right? The things...
And he might see in a way that we don't see, you know, because we store it so much in our brain that we don't see things.
He may, but if he wants to get around, he can't do it, you see. And you see, there was a case, one case of a man who was born blind, and they asked him, what did he see? And he says, oh, I see the experience is taking place on my skin. See, he actually saw it directly. Then he had to learn to project it out there, right? There's another case of a man who was in some institution, you know, and they had uppercase letters embossed on the door, so he knew them by touch. Now, the minute he saw them in a journal, he recognized uppercase letters, right? But he couldn't recognize lowercase letters. You see, because the touch and sight get connected, right? So all that has to be learned and stored up in skill and memory, you see. So the same is true of learning how to hear. And you have to learn how to hear, learn that what you hear and what you see have the same source. Like if you look at somebody, you say the person that you hear is the same as the person that you see. I imagine a blind man might have to learn that. And so on. Now... that illustrates something that we learn mostly as children, when we were very young, that what we see is tremendously affected by what we have learned and how we think about it, right? What people tell us. You see, and in fact, that's necessary if we're going to be able to get around, because we can't stop to think about anything. And then that can go wrong, but then we have ways of correcting it, you see. if it's not quite right. Now, okay. But then we said that what thought mediates, it comes between you and the perception. You see, in fact, you might say with this man who saw, who experienced something on his skin that was very immediate, and then he began to think about it, what does it mean? And he learned gradually to mediate it and then to sense immediately that it means something out there. Not that he has to think, I experienced something here, but it means something out there. But he experiences something out there. You see the difference, huh? So that's what we've learned all along, and we have to have it, right? But that can also go wrong, because we may not realize it's happening, you see. Now, we learn that that person is an enemy, and we experience it, that. We learn all sorts of things of that, too, right? That nature. You know, we learn that we're weak and they're stronger, you know. The child learns all that sort of thing. He experiences himself as weak, right?
About the tangible things like the room, in some sense, aren't we wrong right from the beginning in the sense that the experience is absolute? In other words, our feeling of it is not a relative room to us, but it's a real room to us.
Well, we experience it as really being there, and I think that there is danger there of slipping over. It's not a serious error at that point, but it can, as we move into more subtle questions, it slips into something very serious. Right? Now, because usually you can tell fairly quickly when you've gone wrong about the room, you see, from your senses. But when we come to ourselves and our country and our society, it's not so easy. Because we experience our society in that way too, you see. In fact, where is society? It's nowhere, you see. There's no society, really. It's just a set of institutions and rules and so on by which people agree to work together, but live together. But it's only thought that makes it so, right? You see, if General Motors is a company which everybody agrees must be doing all sorts of things, but if they forgot about it, then it wouldn't exist. All the factories and machinery and so on would make no difference, right? You see, the same with any government or organization or anything, right? So the whole thing exists in thought, and where is that? It's not in any, you know, it's in the thought, collective thought. It's not just thought of one person. And there we see that thought has produced most of what is there. Thought has produced a great deal of what is here, but it has some independent existence. If the mountain thought did not produce, but it may have affected it. The society thought produced, you see, but we seldom treat it that way, you see. We treat it as just there, you see. So thought, that's what thought is constantly doing things and then saying, there it is, right? And keeping it going and saying, what can I do about it? You have the immediate mediated by thought, but the mediation becomes at least relatively immediate, right? It may not be the pure immediate but that the blind man had, but it was almost pure anyway. That's the first point, you see. Now, the second point about thought is that it is an abstraction. Now, the word abstract means to take away, you see, like extract, abstract. Thought takes, the opposite of the abstract is the concrete. From the concrete whole, thought takes away certain parts and considers them, right, mentally. And not really, it doesn't take them away, but in the mind, right, in the image. And that is useful because you can then focus on things that might be important. You see, there's too much in the concrete to think about, right? You focus on what you think is important, and you can then do reasoning. You see, if it's simple, you can reason about it. If it has everything in it, you can't. Huh? You see, so you must abstract. So thought is inherently abstract. Some thoughts are more abstract than others, you see. We could take the thought of the chair, the thought of the table, the thought of various other things, you know, and then a more abstract general thought would be the thought of furniture, right? See, furniture is somewhat more abstract than chairs and tables, But even chairs and tables are an abstraction. They said you can look at this as a piece of metal or in all sorts of ways. Now, so you have the abstract, and a thought is inherently abstract, and abstraction is very powerful. You see, for example, the notion of growth is an abstraction. If you will know, nowhere in the concrete will you see growth, right? Look for growth. You can see something's growing. But talk about economic growth, you see. So where will you see it, right? But the very notion of growth has affected our society profoundly, right? It has produced all sorts of concrete effects. You see, so the function of, yes, so thought produces abstractions, which, however, have concrete results. Now, that brings us to the concrete. See, what is that? Right? Because you have to understand the difference of the abstract and the concrete if we're going to understand what thought is doing. Now, the word concrete has a nice derivation. It's based on concrescent, which means grown together. You know, you imagine a jungle, everything is all grown together, it's all one whole. And you might have to abstract from there, you know, what are the edible plants and what is, and things like that. You see. If we went into the jungle, we couldn't do it, we wouldn't survive. Those who have lived there all their lives make that abstraction easily, and they can survive, right? So the the point now, everybody now, but now this word concrete, I think I'm going to try to suggest an extension of its meaning. You see, I think to be free, to be creative, we cannot always stick to all the customary habitual meanings, right, of words, because if we do that, we'll never get out of a certain limited area. Meanings are constantly being extended. Even in physics, there was an ordinary meaning of the word energy, and people extended it to a certain technical meaning, quite different from the meaning it has in ordinary life, and so on. Now, ordinarily we think of concrete as something very solid, because we have concrete objects, blocks of concrete. But it's interesting to look at the derivation of the word concrete is from concrescent. It has grown together. And you see, actually, it's the cement that makes it concrete. Right? You have sand and rock, pebbles, and the cement holds it into a block of concrete. You see, in fact, that was originally, it was Portland cement, you see, was what made it concrete. Right? Now, you see, so we tend to think of this block as the main point about concreteness, but the main point about concreteness is the cement that makes it all one, right? And so, okay, well, in the case of concrete blocks, the cement is Portland cement that makes a block, but what holds us, what holds society together, what holds people together, you see? What is the concrete reality of society? You see, where is the block? You see, it's something very subtle. It's the exchange, the sharing of meaning, right? If people don't share the similar meaning, society falls apart, right? So the concrete reality of society is very subtle. If we focus on the solid block, we won't find it. See, the buildings, the factories, and all that are not the concrete reality of society. We've just seen that, right? They're the pebbles and the sand. It falls apart without the cement, right? So the without the glue or the cement, whatever you want to call it. So the point is, the sharing of meaning is what holds society together, if it does. But if the meanings are incoherent, society will break up, right?
Is that the same as saying that the glue of society is the abstract, or is that
no? It's I'm going to come to that. I'm going to say it's subtle. That's all I've said so far. I can't put my finger on. The block of concrete we can hold in our hands, right? It's what's called manifest. Manifest means literally in Latin what you could hold in your hand, right? Now, but it isn't the thing that holds society together isn't manifest. You can't put it in your hand, right? The things you can put in your hand won't hold society together. So the so what is the nature? You've raised the question. What is the nature of this subtle concrete? glue, cement, right? So I'm going to suggest, now you have raised the question, I say sharing of meaning, right? So I'm saying the concrete basis of society is this meaning, whatever meaning is. Now, meaning is not just abstract. You see, behind meaning is something concrete, I want to say, the concrete reality of, say, thought itself or of the mind process itself, right? Is that clear what I mean? That so behind that is meaning, right? Now, in an elementary case, it's thought which has a certain meaning, words which have a certain meaning, but it more, there may be more subtle meanings, right?
For, let's say, a table, for an individual, the concrete reality is the meaning. The meaning is, in a sense, what the table is, what it represents to him.
Yes, and also the meaning of the whole room is what holds it all together. The meaning of your life is what would hold it together, right? See, if it lacks that meaning, then you feel it's falling apart, right? Yeah. If society lacks a common meaning, it's not holding, right? Or the culture lacks it, right? Now you see, culture is the shared meaning, right? And now meaning includes not only significance, which you know what that is, but also value and purpose. These are the three meanings of the word meaning, right? So, you see, the sharing of common significance, value, and purpose will hold the society together, right? If they don't share it, it's incoherent and it goes apart. Now, we have a lot of subgroups in our society that don't share meanings and it starts to fall apart, you see.
It almost sounds too mechanical.
Why?
That these things actually can hold society together. It sounds like they couldn't really.
Why not?
Well, it would seem like the thing that would hold the society together would be not. It wouldn't be a thing. There's nothing you could.
Well, yeah, but meaning is not a thing.
Okay.
So you can't point to the meaning. It's very subtle.
Right. But then you say shared values.
Well, that's some of the aspects of meaning. You see, if we wanted to say what the meaning itself, the concrete reality of the meaning, we can't get hold of, right? But we can experience it in various forms, like the significance, the value, and the purpose, right? You see, if we share meanings, then we will have a common purpose and a common value, which certainly will help hold us together. Now, but that, what that means more deeply, we have to go into.
Is the difference between significance, value, and purpose important for this discussion? And if so, could you...
Well, there's not a fundamental difference. There are really different aspects of the same thing, right? That there are three... The dictionary gives these three meanings of the word meaning, right? Now, significance has the word sign in. It sort of points to something. You see, what is the significance of this, what we're talking about, right? That's one idea of meaning. Is that clear? What is the significance of what we're doing and all that? Now, but then value is something which is part of it. If something is very significant, you may sense it as having a high value, right? Now, the word value has a root which is interesting, same as valor and valiant. It means strong. You might suppose that in early times when people sensed something of high value, they didn't have a word for it, but it moved them, right? Strongly. Later they found a word for it and said it has high value, and then later the word itself may convey that. Now, if something is significant, it may have a high value, and if it has a high value, you may have develop a strong purpose or intention to get it or sustain it or something, right? Things that don't have high value will not generate any very strong purpose, you see. So you say it's not interesting, right? It doesn't mean much to me. Right? It means a lot to me. It means it has a high value. And I mean to do it is the same as to say it's my purpose. Right? So you can see the word meaning has those three meanings. And I don't think it's an accident. I think they're in very deeply related.
What about the sense that I sometimes have that we pretend to share meaning? Is that because there's a higher value that we have to get along? Because oftentimes I feel we just pretend.
We may pretend to share, which means it won't work. I mean, but then we say it's very important for us to not to fall apart, so we'd better share, right?
body to hold these things.
Yeah, but then it doesn't really work because it will then be a kind of violence trying to impose some sharing which is not there, right? You see, we may then, if it isn't working, we are inclined to go into some use force, right? When the right way isn't working, then we fall back to force, right?
One of the shared meanings that we, you're saying that the shared meaning is incoherent?
It becomes,
and,
yeah.
And one of the shared meanings we have is that we all believe in violence.
Yes, right. We share that, but we... But the kind of meaning that we've shared is not going to bring about coherence. That we share incoherence, that doesn't. It's a kind of paradox.
Violence is the way in which we try to enforce this incoherence.
Yeah.
And maintain it.
Yeah. So what we share is not the right thing to share. You see, true sharing must be coherent, right?
You use the word right thing, right way, several times now, and that's what always confuses me. Because I've always assumed that the right way is a relative term in every culture. And
yes.
How does one decide what is the right way?
Yes, yes. Well, that would be an assumption that that's always the case. You see, maybe it's often the case, what you said.
Is it not the case?
Well, just simply right now in what you said, you see, you questioned something I said, right? You were implying that in your questioning was a right question, not relative.
No, I don't understand.
Well, you see, what was the meaning of it?
I want clarification.
Yeah, but what was the meaning of your question?
That I don't understand your use of the term right at this point.
Yeah.
In discussing significance and value.
Yeah, are you suggesting that my use of the term right is not right?
I'm suggesting that I don't understand
how
to use it. And I would like it clarified.
Yeah, well, do you sense something wrong with the way I'm using it? In other words, does it jar you in some way?
Yes, because you've been talking about openness,
yeah.
And then you use the word right, and that seems to be not congruent.
Yes, all right, well, we'll use another word. But see, I think I wanted to bring in another issue at the same time, but let's... what I only meant by the word right is exactly what you meant by the word openness, because you see, you are using the word openness in the sense that that is what would be the right way, you see. I don't think we can entirely get out of the use of the word right. You see, I think that's one of those paradoxes of language, that when we try to say something is always the case, we get into problems of coherence. So we have to leave open a little bit, right? We brought in openness, and even openness could get to be wrong, right? Could get to so it requires a sensitivity and so on. So I can say, okay, you can object to my use of the word right, but you must realize that you still have that same problem. And we have the problem that we are going to have to be sensitive to the use of language, that we are not, that when we get into the use of absolutes, we get into difficulties. That, but if we say never use absolutes, we are in total difficulty. our language itself has paradoxical features, which we should have to, which we really have to think about. Right?
Wouldn't the difficulty only arise if we believed in the language?
Yes, well, we have to say, take our language with a grain of salt, as they say, you see. or maybe two.
Well, I guess I was basically pressing you for the root of valuation.
Yeah. Well, I think values arise as a perception deeply, a sense that this means something to me. Meaning is perceived fundamentally, you see. It's a perception through the mind, which uses the senses and thought and everything. And I can't say, see, meaning is very close to the foundation of the mind, right? And somehow we can perceive meaning, or we can also take meaning from the past, from thought. Say, you know, and we can bring the two together and so on. Now, we have to have coherent meaning, you see. You see, when coherent thought is only a part of the question of coherent meaning, because from the meaning we act, right? And the meaning determines our whole being. Because as things mean something different, we change, right? So if our meaning is incoherent, then we are incoherent in our being. We will be engaged in conflict and so on, I see. So, now, the language itself has a certain possibility for incoherence, which is part of the reason why the human species is in trouble. That people trying to do the right thing, just so-and-so, have got into this absolute and done the wrong thing, right? You see, so there's a kind of paradox there that requires some sensitivity. We cannot actually, at this stage, let us say that we want to see if we can find a coherent way of approaching the question, right? I mean, explore it. And the, but anyway, where were we now? That the thing did not work properly when we it became incoherent, you see. And on the other hand, we can say we must be careful not to dismiss incoherence altogether, because we're bound to become incoherent. You see, the question is only, what is our attitude to incoherence? If we defend ourselves against acknowledging that we are incoherent, then this causes trouble, right? Now, therefore, incoherence is part of learning, right? We learn that we are incoherent, and then we learn something else. And we don't reach absolute coherence. We're constantly moving, right? So we have a question of language there, which we'll have to come to as well. But that's part of thought, right? Part of the problem of thought has been that it has developed the notion of absolute. It had to. And yet that notion of absolute has a paradox in it, which has not been resolved, right? It may be intrinsic, I don't know, you see, for all we know. So we're back on the question of the concrete. Right? The concrete process of meaning of the mind, you see, what is it? You see, we can't put our finger on it, right? It's entirely subtle, right? Elusive. But it's there. You see, you can get a clue to this by considering what Polanyi has called tacit knowledge. That when, for example, you ride a bicycle, you have countless little movements by which you keep it in balance. You can't describe them or put your finger on them. If you try to describe them, you would fall, right? You see, you simply do it. Now, you can't say where it starts from or anything, you see. Now, it may have countless sources. Now, however, you turn in the direction in which you fall, and there's a formula you can calculate from physics that the angle of tilt and the angle of turn must be related by some formula, that one is the square of the other. But that's you satisfy that if you're riding the bicycle properly, but you're not thinking about it while you're riding. So you don't use it to ride the bicycle, right? So I think we all realize that we do almost everything by tacit knowledge, right? Now I ask a question, how do you think? I want to think, you see, I have a problem to solve, right? So will you give me directions how to think, right? I mean, what shall I do? You see, what can I do? You see, I use tacit knowledge of how to think in thinking, right? I'm going to claim that it's even more subtle than riding the bicycle. So that tacit process is what happens when you're thinking. Now, if you're doing it properly, your thoughts will follow a logical order, just as your bicycle will satisfy the formula, right? You see, if you try to impose the logical order, that is not the right way to think. Many people believe that the right way to think is to impose a logical order. And in fact, people in artificial intelligence think that they can cover the whole of thinking by just working it out on some kind of program, you know, a very complex, infinite program. I suggest that thinking is a subtle movement, meaning, whatever it is even more subtle. But it is the concrete reality of the process. In other words, that is what's happening to produce, the function of this concrete process of thinking is to produce abstractions. as the function of the factory is to produce products, right?
So we normally think of meaning as something produced by thought. Mm-hmm. You're suggesting otherwise.
Yes, I think meaning is, it can be produced from thought, but more generally it isn't, right? You know, thought contributes. But even thought is a concrete process which we cannot get hold of. You know, we know that thought will have electric currents, you know, people have made measurements, chemical changes, the blood moves in the brain, but that isn't the whole, that isn't the essential point, right?
Wondering, is our, if we rode bicycles the way we thought, we'd be crashing all over the place currently. But it seems as though then our tacit knowledge about we think that our tacit knowledge about thinking is correct.
Yeah.
There seem to be some very serious mistakes in our tacit knowledge about thinking. Is that, we don't seem to know that or be aware of it.
Yes.
We assume that it's correct as we're thinking and talking.
Yeah, I think that's one of the basic mistakes which has developed with the human race. You see, people began by just thinking, you know. As you breathe, you think, you know, you don't, then, but then people began to develop thoughts about how they think, right? Now, these thoughts were often incorrect and led to confusion, to incoherence. See, the thought about your thinking can affect your thinking, right?
Example of a thought about thinking that is
possibly? Well, for example, you should be a right-thinking person who agrees with your community, right? You know, with all the people around you. You see, saying the community expects you to be a right-thinking person who has the right, correct opinions. And you've got to impose them. You see, if you're not right, we've got to impose it, right? We've got to use force. Now, that's going to affect thinking profoundly. Is that clear? It will induce a lot of fear and conflict. Or else if you think, I must think logically by following the rules, that will get in your way, right?
Is it something that gets in the way of what they call positive thinking? Because you say something that negates it. Right away, there's a number of people, especially now with the New Age, that tell you that's your negativity.
What?
Negativity, okay. They say. So you don't have a positive thinking. But is that positive thinking as well something that gets in the way of thinking?
Well, I think that all those things get in the way. You see, if somebody says engage solely in positive thinking, that's a rule that you've set up which may get in the way, you see, of this tacit process which really does it right. Well, I apologize for the word right, but does it coherently, right? Somebody tells you, you think only positively. Somebody else says, no, think negatively. You know, you must watch out for all the mistakes and so on, right? But you really need to do both, huh? Or if somebody else says, pull yourself together, you say, cheer up, right? They're affecting your thinking. They're telling you to think thoughts that'll do that, aren't they? Now, that may not make much sense. You see, you may have a lot of thoughts that are pulling you apart, depressing you and so on, and you're not really facing them, you see. You see, the human race is full of traditional ways by which thought thinks about how it should work, right?
Aren't essentially most organized religions based on that?
Yes, I mean, think God, you know, think fear of God, obedience to God, right? Put God first, you know. There are various ways which you, if you think, you will then, the suggestion is you will bring the rest into harmony, right?
The IBM machine used to have a sign that just said, think.
Think. Well, it's all right. But you see, what does it mean is the question, right? You know, the word think has also all these meanings that have been developed, right? Yeah. Well, we should have a break now, I think. I don't know, 15. Yes, I think.
Right.
Everybody can think about this in the next 15 minutes.